Welcome, and thank you all for standing by. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session. For you to ask a question, you may press star one and record your name when prompted. Today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now, I will turn the meeting over to your host, Mr. James Miner, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Higher Education Programs. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. I want to thank you for joining us today and this afternoon for what we here in the department refer to as a stakeholder call. We're very excited to engage you this afternoon about a new grant competition, which is referred to as First in the World. With me this afternoon are a handful of colleagues from the department, Ralph Fiennes, John English, Marsha Silverberg, Margo Anderson, Mary Wall, Julie Hines. But we are also pleased that our Secretary of Education was able to join us this afternoon to not only greet you, but to provide a brief overview for our call today. So without further ado, let me introduce Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan.
Thanks so much, James, and welcome to the team. James, if you guys don't know, just recently joined us, and this is a pretty fun project to start out, start hitting the ground working on. So do some great work together on this. As he said, thanks to all of you for taking the time. Over the next decade, the majority of job opportunities in the U.S., as all of you know, will require some level of post-secondary education, making a high-quality post-secondary education a critical step on the pathway to opportunity. Unfortunately, barriers like rising college costs make it pretty difficult for many students and families, particularly those from underserved and disadvantaged backgrounds, who have access to persist in, and to complete post-secondary study. President Obama knows that earning some form of post-secondary education is the single most important investment students and families can make in their long-term future. And last August, he outlined an ambitious agenda to combat rising college costs and help make college more affordable, increase quality, and improve educational outcomes. The president's plan included paying for performance by developing a college rating system, promoting innovation and completion in the higher education marketplace, and ensuring debt is affordable and manageable for students. The president noted that the federal government can act as a catalyst for innovation, spurring innovation in a way that drives down costs while preserving or actually increasing quality. Innovation can take many forms, and the First in the World, as a key part of the president's college value and affordability agenda, aims to support a wide range of innovations at colleges and universities across the nation and serve as a catalyst for the best ideas that can dramatically enhance student outcomes. As an evidence-based grant program, First in the World will provide awards to institutions of higher education and support the development and evaluation of innovative approaches and strategies that will improve educational access and outcomes and make post-secondary education more affordable and attainable for students and their families. Colleges all around the country are exploring and testing innovative approaches and strategies that aim to obtain better outcomes for students. This includes areas like competency-based education that measure progress based upon outcomes rather than seat time, dual enrollment strategies that allow high school students to earn college credit before they graduate from high school, and the redesigning of teaching and learning that can help reduce the time to degree as well as reducing costs. First in the World aims to harness these types of innovation that have the potential to revolutionize the way students earn a degree or credential. Through the First in the World program, our administration is calling on institutions of higher ed to provide us with their best, most promising ideas to develop and test cutting-edge approaches to improve outcomes for students, particularly those from underrepresented, underprepared, or low-income backgrounds. We hope that through this program, institutions will pioneer new and innovative ways to increase college access and success, reduce the time it takes for students to complete their higher education degree or certificate, and improve affordability for students and families so that more Americans can get the education training they desperately need to be successful in our global economy. The evidence-based approach of First in the World is important, as it is designed to expand the research on innovative practices so that institutions can adopt models that prove to be successful. The First in the World program gets its name from the goal that President Obama set for our nation early on in our administration that by the year 2020, the United States would once again be the first in the world in college completion. With this vision, we are excited to ask colleges and universities nationwide for their best ideas to improve college attainment and affordability, and we look forward to unleashing a new wave of innovation when awards are announced later this fall. Thanks so much. I'm going to hand it back over to James, who will walk you through in some detail this 2014 competition. James?
Thank you very much, Ernie. I want to just take a couple of minutes to offer a few additional details about the 2014 competition. The first thing I want to say is that the notice for the First in the World competition was published in the Federal Register on Volume 79, Number 95, for those of you who cataloged the Federal Register, this past Friday, May 16th. Additional information and details are also available on the FIPSE website. For those of you who may not know, FIPSE stands for the Fund for the Improvement of Postsecondary Education. It should be very easy to find on the department's website. I also want to let you know that we are planning to have two webinars for the First in the World competition that have been scheduled. The first is scheduled for May 28th from 1:30 to 3:30 Eastern Standard Time. And the second is scheduled for June 4th, 1:30 to 3:30 Eastern Standard Time. You must register for the webinars, and registration information for those webinars is available or will be available on the FIPSE website. A couple of other additional details. The application deadline for this competition is June 30th, 2014. The review process will run roughly from July 21st through August 29th, and then the announcement of the awards will be made on or before September 30th, 2014. A total of $75 million has been appropriated for the 2014 competition. Up to $20 million of that $75 has been set aside for minority-serving institutions, which you'll hear us refer to as MSIs later in the call. We are anticipating making anywhere between 19 and 38 grants, which will range between $2 and $4 million. We anticipate that the average grant award will be about $3 million over the four-year grant period. Institutions of higher education, individually or in consortia, are eligible to apply. Institutions of higher education may partner with public or private agencies or associations, but those agencies are not eligible to apply individually in this year's competition. Again, these are all details that are available on the department's FIPSE website that should be very easily accessible to you. There are five absolute priorities that must be addressed for this competition. It is important to note that the department will only consider applications that address one of the following five priorities. The first is increasing access and completion for underrepresented, underprepared, low-income students. The second priority is the increasing community college transfer rates to four-year colleges, and specifically for underrepresented, underprepared, and low-income students. Absolute priority number three, increasing enrollment and completion of underrepresented, underprepared, and low-income students, specifically in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, which we all refer to as STEM, and those various degree and certificate programs. Absolute priority number four, reducing time to completion. And again, these are focused for underrepresented, underprepared, or low-income students. Absolute priority number five is improving college affordability, especially for underrepresented, underprepared, and low-income students. So I want to make those priorities absolutely clear. I think folks in the department have consulted far and wide in terms of those priorities and making sure they align with the president's goal and the spirit of the competition. I want to say just a couple of other things about what we think characterizes a successful First in the World project. There are probably as many as six here that I'm going to list for you, which are also outlined in the notice, but they're sort of characteristics that we think will embody a successful project. The first is a project design that is supported by a strong theory. It's defined in the notice. Two is a data collection plan, which we'll talk a little bit about later in the call, 3, a design and implementation plan for evaluation that will demonstrate whether or not the strategies implemented are showing moderate evidence or effectiveness as defined, again, in the notice. Number 4, we're interested in projects that might be deemed replicable or scalable in terms of the reform strategies outlined. The 5th, a strong focus on improved post-secondary access, affordability, and completion, again, with an emphasis on low-income students. And the 6th is a strategy for improvement in post-secondary productivity, effectiveness that holds a steady or that holds steady or decreases the actual cost for students. So what I've just shared with you are the absolute priorities for the competition and 6 characteristics that we think will embody successful projects for the competition. 2 other pieces of information I want to share with you before we move into our question and answer part of the call. The first has to do with evidence. I really do think what many of you who have participated in competitions previously will see increased focus on the level of evidence associated with these projects. So to be eligible for an award in this year's competition, a development grant must be supported by a strong theory. And I think that's important. The final, you know, sort of piece of that, the application must submit what we're referring to as a logic model for the proposed project. The applicants may submit a rationale for interventions that have not been tested or tried, but and that only have marginally been considered or explored in the higher education community. So, again, focus on strong theory and a logic model, which must be a part of the applications. Finally, I want to, on this point of evidence, just make one other point or highlight one other point in the competition notice, and that is a competitive preference priority that applications will receive additional 2 points, 2 additional points for this competitive priority for applications using what we refer to as evidence or promise as the application of evidence standard. And that is clearly, that standard of evidence is clearly spelled out in the What Works Clearinghouse evidence standards, which is also available on the IES website. So having said that, I'll end there. I want to pass it over to my colleague, Mary Wall, who will facilitate the question and answer portion of the call. Mary?
Thanks, James. And Anna, we are ready for to go into questions and answers.
All right. Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask questions, please press star and then the number 1. Please unmute your phone and record your name clearly when prompted. Your name is required to introduce your question. To withdraw your request, press star then number 2. 1 moment, please, for the first question. Right, our first question will be coming from the line of that will be Peter, your line is open.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. We're a national organization that's a consortium of higher education campuses, and we also have state affiliates. And I'm wondering about multiple applications being put in, even though the organizations are separate, how would that work, and if it's allowable, even though they have the same name?
Hi, this is Mary. I'm not quite sure I'm understanding your question, so I'm gonna try to provide some context, and you should feel free to ask if this isn't right. But an institution would be eligible to put their name on one application as the lead applicant, but would be eligible to participate in other applications that are consist of consortia of institutions. But the only eligible applicants for the first world competition are institutions of higher education.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Our next question will be coming from the line of Mr. Damian Williams. Mr. Williams, your line is open.
Hi, thank you, Mrs. Wall, for taking my question. I'm Damian Williams from Kansas State University. And my university, along with seven others, are part of a program called the First Scholars Program. And I was wondering, could you give more background on the types of organizations that we can partner with that are not institutions of higher education?
Actually, the organizations that you can partner with, private and public organizations, we don't really have a recommendation per se. There are lots of organizations out there, I'm sure, that you work with. So really, we're not being prescriptive. We're just saying that institutions have to be the applicant, but they can partner with a variety of private and public nonprofit institutions and organizations.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
All right, thank you. Our next question will be coming from the line of Ms. Robin Tree. Ma'am, your line is open.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. I am from McDaniel College, which is a small liberal arts college, and we were wondering if this is an environment where we can be competitive with all of the other large institutions and consortiums that are interested.
So we believe, yes, that you can be competitive in this environment. We are really, we have put a lot of thought into the notice inviting applications as well as the questions and answers and application package that are provided on the website where we discuss First in the World to indicate what makes for a strong application. And as you just heard James kind of go over some of the criteria, there's a lot of different components there. We believe that institutions of all sizes and in a great diversity of them would be really well suited to put in strong applications and ultimately receive funding. We recognize, of course, that there are that the size of the award is relatively small in terms of the overall size of amount of funding, which again we do think will also play to smaller institutions as well as larger institutions who are say looking at a subset of students that they would be working with as part of a proposed project. But there is, we believe that this competition is very open to both, and we encourage both to apply.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. One moment for the next question. All right, our next question will be coming from the line of Ms. Sarah. Ms. Sarah, your line is open.
Good afternoon. I'm calling from Western Washington University, and I had a question in regards to the absolute priorities. I know that there are five that have been listed. Are you leaning towards grant applications that are focusing specifically on one priority, or what are your thoughts about potentially looking at different elements of our plans that cut across those priorities?
We were very intentional in doing this. We recognized that there would be some degree of overlap for sure amongst those priorities and that an institution really could write a proposal for a project that could speak to any number of those. But we are asking for institutions to really focus on one of them and on the spirit of what that priority is looking for. So specifically, to give an example of the first priority, increasing access and completion, really looking comprehensively about at what gaps, say, exist in an institution or a consortium of institutions that you'd be looking to close either through some proposed project that would get at access and persistence and ultimately completion for underrepresented, underprepared, or low-income students. I think it's clear that in that there could be cost savings that would be delivered to a student. In other words, that could speak to college affordability, or that even you could imagine that some of them could work towards a reduced time to completion or an on-time completion, which again would get at the idea of cost savings for students. But we're asking applicants to pick one of these areas so that as we are evaluating all applications, we have the clearest sense of what the institution's focus is. there is we are simply putting all of these priorities out there without an express guarantee that we would be funding projects in all of these areas. We will look at all of the projects across all priorities, and we will be funding the highest quality applications. So it may be that we fund within all five priorities, or it may not, and that will depend on the overall quality of the applications that we receive.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Our next question will be coming from the line of Ms. Nora Gardner. Ma'am, your line is open.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my question. My name is Nora Garza from Laredo Community College, and I'm here with colleagues from Texas State University. We have a question. Provided that we expect a strong theory for our proposal or proposal, are there limitations on the allowable activities?
Well, the idea is that you're going to propose a project that has various components that support the main thrust of your project. And so the idea that the Department of Education, certainly under our rules and regulations, do have certain limitations, but going forward, basically, you would only want to ask for funds that are absolutely necessary to implement the program and that are reasonable. So to that extent, I wouldn't say not to be concerned at this point, but there would be an opportunity for you to ask more specific questions along this line, certainly on our webinar, which we're going to hold on the 28th and the 3rd of June. But you can also talk to our program staff if you have a specific issue or an item that you really have a concern about.
Yes, sir, like tuition, stipends, things like that.
No, I think my colleague Ralph Hines is suggesting is that we're not overly prescriptive about budget line items so long as they are clearly associated with the project and the priorities that have been outlined in this competition. So, you know, as long as they're, you know, sort of in keeping what we typically see in projects in higher education, I don't think we're overly prescriptive there. If you're running a program or you're proposing a program or project that's focused on increasing access and completion for underrepresented students, and a component of your program or project involves paying stipends to tutors or individuals who are helping students transition from high school to college, whatever the nature of that project is, I think in general terms would be permissible.
And to be clear, just to add on to that, this is an institutional grant program, so it would a non-permissible use of funds, for instance, would be direct student assistance using this money. So in other words, scholarships to students. But again, as part of a program, and as Ralph and James have described, you will propose what you see as the associated costs. And if there are specific questions about things that you're thinking of, we would again be happy to address those in one of the webinars over the next 2 weeks.
Our next question is coming from the line of Sydney Johnson. Mr. Johnson, your line is open.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate this conference call opportunity. My question has to do with your addressing cost share and recovering indirect costs. Could you explain both of those to us, please? Thank you.
When you say cost share and indirect costs, the indirect cost for this training grant program is 8%. So when you say recovery, it's only 8% for this program. So beyond that, I'm not sure what your question is.
How much does the institution have to contribute as part of its share of the grant?
There's no matching requirement for this program, but obviously if you're requesting funds from the department, certainly the institution would want to be a partner in this. So I think you would want to use certainly your judgment to determine what it is that that the institution can support and what is necessary to enable this program, this project to go forward.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Our next question will be coming from the line of Mr. Matthew Swanson. Mr. Swanson, your line is open.
Hello, and thank you. My question is regarding what you see as the appropriate balance between providing a strong theory on the one hand and wanting to implement genuinely innovative practices on the other. How would you suggest applicants strike a balance between providing that strong theory without, and at the same time being sufficiently innovative to fulfill this competition's expectations?
You know,
Go ahead, James.
I was just going to briefly say, you know, it's a great question, and I think what we're hoping to see in this competition are things that our colleagues in the field have reason to believe are particularly effective or successful in terms of improving student outcomes and improving degree completion. And, you know, I have not at least thought of them as a balancing act, which might indicate you have to have, you know, one or the other, or there's a sort of a trade-off. I think what we're looking for with respect to strong theory is logic, evidence, or rationale of why this particular approach or practice or set of policies in tandem with practice actually work for students. And so, I mean, that's the way we tended to think about it, not that there's sort of a trade-off. A theory is a theory, right? Assumptions about how something happens or a particular phenomenon. And some theories are strong and some are less strong, and I guess what we're asking for are if you have assumptions about why a particular practice or policy or teaching and learning strategy is effective, we just ask you to spell out theoretically why you believe that to be the case.
Thanks, James. I would just add to that that it is that this is in our first year of this program. As you saw in the notice inviting applications, this is for development grants only, which is, as we have indicated, as an eligibility requirement, requires strong theory with the submission of a logic model. And as James had mentioned, it is additional evidence is incentivized through the competitive preference priority. But the approach here, and it's similar to the approach that the department has taken in the Investing in Innovation program, or the I3 program, is that it is a it will be a tiered evidence framework in future years. So in other words, in order to be eligible in future competitions, again, this is not in this year's competition, but that there would be more than one tier of evidence and more than one tier of funding that institutions would be eligible to apply for. So that would be kind of a look at the future of this, but again, for the time being, we invite you to submit your best and most promising ideas based on a strong theory, and again, if you choose to submit additional evidence via the competitive preference priority.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Our next question will be coming from the line of Mr. Christopher Hodson from Howard University. Sir, your line is open.
Yes, thank you. I think Mr. Johnson's question covered mine. It had to do with the evidence issue. So I'm going.
All right, next question.
All right, one moment, please. Once again, just a reminder for the participants to ask a question, please press star 1. You will be prompted to record your name. To withdraw your question, please press star 2.
So if that means we don't have a question presently, I wonder if it's worth elaborating just a little bit more on the evidence. Piece of this, and Mary, I think your point about future years is well taken. I mean, if you heard Secretary Duncan mention earlier, there's so much emphasis placed on innovation. And we know that there are lots of great things that are happening in the higher education community. But we also know that there's not a lot of evidence to support the effectiveness of those practices or the innovation that's going forth across the sector. And so we really are interested in that. You know, there's a lot of back and forth internally about what the level of evidence should be for the first year of the competition. And I think the development grants that will be made this year represent that. And we know what we're anticipating is that the buildup of evidence will happen over or in the following years of the competition. So what we're hoping to see is lots of innovation and strong theory about why there's reason to believe that those practices are or will be particularly effective.
Thank you, Jim. Anna, are there additional questions in the queue?
Yes, we do have. All right, our next question will be coming from Mr. Edward Levine. Sir, your line is open.
Good afternoon. My question is related to points added or deducted or preference shown by institutional type or size. Does the accreditor of an institution matter, or its tax status for profit or not for profit status in the application or probability of success?
The answer to that question is no. There is no points added or taken away based on this, the size of the institution, the type of it. As long as it's non-profit, a public or private institution, then they would be eligible, assuming they fit within the general category or the category of MSI.
So, pardon me, I didn't hear you. So you're saying that profit status does matter?
Non-profit. Public and private institutions of higher education. For-profit institutions are not eligible to compete in this competition.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Our next question will be coming from the line of Ms. Sarah Katz. Have your line here.
Hi, Sarah Katz from Brandon University. We are a Hispanic-serving institution, and we want to make sure that that designation is part of an MSI.
It is, yes. In order to be considered an MSI as part of the competition, you'll see in the application package that it is there is a space for you to indicate that you are that you would be considered an MSI. And that would be that would include a Hispanic-serving institution. As is indicated there as well, you do not need to have the designation of MSI currently and or be receiving funds as an HSI or another MSI currently in order to be considered an MSI for the purpose of this competition, as long as you are able to demonstrate that you would meet the conditions in order to be considered an MSI, then you are considered that for first in the world.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Our next question will be coming from the line of Ms. Teresa Miles-Hendrick from Texas Christian University. Ma'am, your line is open.
Yes. Good afternoon. Thanks for having us. We would like to know, is there a specific sample size going into these developmental grants at all and the outcome?
Well, our sample size, can you, I don't think I'm clear about what you're asking. You're asking about a sample size?
With respect to the students, with respect to the respondents in the project we may develop, is there a specific sample size for that or a minimum? Is there a minimum sample size?
No, there is no minimum number of students who would need to be served as part of the project. Again, you would be developing a project and indicating in that proposal the anticipated number of students that you would serve.
However, we encourage you to review the definitions for moderate evidence of effectiveness, which is what you will have to design your evaluation around should you be a successful grantee. because in order to achieve that standard, there are some definitions that relate to sample size regarding that standard. So it would be useful to review those criteria.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Our next question will be coming from the line of Mr. John McVeigh from Walla Walla University.
Hi, can you tell me what percentage of your student population has to be underrepresented in order to qualify for this grant?
So there is no designated percentage of a student population that would have to be considered underrepresented, underprepared, or low income for the purpose of this grant. We are, again, looking to you in your proposal to develop a project around those students on your campuses. And again, looking to you as part of the evaluation of your of a successful grantee's project as well to indicate how there have been measurable advancements or achievements for that student population. But we are not stipulating any certain percentage or absolute figure of students there.
Thank you.
All right. Our next question will be coming from the line of Mr. French from Miles College. Sir, your line is open.
Thank you so much, and let me thank Pepsi for this great opportunity to put together. I'm just uncertain about one point. I understand that the lead institution would be a nonprofit institution of higher education. However, may we partner with a private for-profit educational consulting firm?
Would you be able to repeat that question? You were going in and out on the line.
Yes, ma'am. Let me say again, thank you to Pepsi for this great opportunity and for taking my question. I know that the lead organization would have to be a nonprofit institution of higher education, as Miles College is, but I was wondering if we may partner with a for-profit educational consulting company, which specializes in evaluation and assessment.
Yes, for the purpose of if you are looking at it again for the purpose of evaluation and assessment, that that would be permissible.
Great, great. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you. Our next question will be coming from the line of Mr. Ron Hamm. Sir, your line is open. Mr. Ron Hamm.
Yes, this is Ron Hamm. Thank you very much for taking my call today and for the information. In the priority areas, I know you mentioned that you must focus on one of those. But what if you are doing a number of those things well? I mean, does that enhance the competitiveness of the application, or could it hurt you in that you're not as focused as you would want it to be?
The purpose of these absolute priorities, obviously, because we really want to get the research and background data on where we are and really specific interventions. So while we indicated early on that we realize that if you focus on one absolute priority, there may be certainly a bleeding into the other areas, obviously, but we do want you to indicate very clearly and very strongly that you have chosen one of the absolute priorities. We don't want you to say, well, we do all of them well. And I think that does not help us really to really start segregate and identify the different projects that would fall under those buckets. But the fact of the matter is that we realize that several of them are complementary.
Yes.
But we do really want you to pick one, and then perhaps if it bleeds, as I said early on, into others, I think logically, then certainly that would be okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Our next question will be coming from the line of Mr. Malikichi from Delaware State University.
Hi. Thank you for taking my question, and thank you for a great presentation. My question is relates to what happens after the grant is over. I heard one of the priorities and one of the characteristics of a good proposal is to show replicability. But are you also, and I assume you are, but I just want to make sure, looking for that we demonstrate that the program will be sustainable at our institution after the grant is over?
Yes, actually, FIPSI in its history has always really looked very closely at projects that had the great potential for not only replication, but also institutionalization. So to the extent that this program will be established at your institution, you'll build on it, and certainly there will be clear evidence that it will have a great chance of being continued, and that other institutions perhaps would see it as a model. So we do want to see some longevity with regard to the results of this particular project.
And in the spirit, just to add to that, in the spirit of the innovation of this program, of course, there would be, as is indicated in the notice, a rigorous evaluation associated with this. So the idea would be that we are looking to certainly to be able to provide the field, the higher education community in general, more of a base of what works. And so we certainly know that we're certainly hopeful for many and or all successful projects, but this is also something where we will be testing new and innovative approaches. And so we want to be able to identify those that work, and for those that work, continue to spread and expand them.
Yeah, I think that's well said, Mary. I have always thought of this as the sort of coming together of innovation and evidence. Right, so the idea of it simply being innovative without evidence that is suggestive that it is particularly effective, I don't view as all that helpful. So I really do appreciate you sort of highlighting the sort of coming together of innovation with defensible evidence that these innovative practices actually are effective.
Thank you so much. Really, that's very helpful. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Our next question will be coming from the line of Ms. Sarah. Ma'am, your line is open.
Yes, I had two additional questions. One had to do with the webinars and if those two dates are the same webinar being offered twice, or are they covering different types of questions? So that's my first question. My second one really has to do with the four-year award and whether I'm assuming we are submitting a proposal that is for all 4 years and building a budget over 4 years, or is this on a year-to-year contingency?
The answer to your first question is that the webinar for May 28th and the webinar for June 4th, there will be we'll repeat the information that we offer on May 28th, but we will certainly add some additional information based on questions that perhaps come forth during the May 28th. So the point is that we know there are lots of folks who will sign up for those webinars, and we're not asking anyone to have to sit in on both. But that, and the fact that we'll have frequently asked questions on our website, is I don't think it's necessary for anyone to have to sit in on both sessions. They will be similar, and it would be, I think, repetitive for someone to sit through both.
Great, thank you.
Now, the second question had to do with, the 4 years. The grants will be for 4 years, so you do need to present a plan, a budget, and other supporting data that would certainly represent the program over the four-year life of the project.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Our next question will be coming from the line of Mr. Robert Kramer of University of Wisconsin.
Hi, this is Tammy Salmon-Stevens. Rob's sitting next to me here, so if it sounds weird having a female versus a male voice. A couple of questions. Is there some criteria or definition for underrepresented, underserved, I'm using the right words, underprepared or low-income students? The second question is, can funding be used to support K-12 students in pool development for higher education? And the third question I have is, if we're awarded the grant, when would it start? Because if we're planning and it starts right in September, that has an impact on how we do the planning for the proposal. Thank you.
Let me start with the last question. The grant would start October 1. of this year. And the the first year of the grant would run from October 1 through September 30th of 2015. And for the question related to K-12 students, this grant is to institutions of higher education, and while they may work with K-12 on a certain level, it's not designed to support students in the K-12 arena. So you want to be very careful with the suggestions and the plans that you put forth that would certainly fall outside of what an institution of higher education should be doing to try to improve access, persistence, and completion.
And certainly, I'd just add that there could be plenty of innovative strategies that could work very comprehensively with a school district or a collaboration of K-12 schools as well. I think what I heard you ask about whether or not the money could go directly to K-12 students. Again, just like on the just like students in post-secondary institutions, it is not you cannot use these funds as direct student financial aid or assistance. And finally, I think to answer your other question, there are not explicit definitions of underrepresented, underprepared, or low-income students in the NOTUS. I think we'll be we're coming up on the end of the hour, so operator, I think we're going to be able to take two more questions.
Two more questions. All right. All right. Our next question. One moment. That will be coming from the line of Ms. Donna Martin of Northern Illinois University.
Hello. I had a question about the number of awards that are possible. I understand that an institution can submit one proposal as the lead applicant and one, or participate in other consortium applications.
That's correct.
Council will only receive one award.
That's correct. So the idea is that an institution would be able to submit a single application as the lead applicant, in other words, as the institution who would be receiving funding, as the first in the world grant would go to a single institution. However, if an institution elected to participate in some consortium or consortia of institutions, they would be able to be a partner with on another grant application. Again, though, they would not be able to be the lead entity in more than one application or receive more than one award, either as an individual institution or as a in terms of the lead of a consortium.
Okay, it would be possible to receive an award as part of two different consortiums, though?
Well, two different certain that in those two different consortia, you would have two different lead institutions who would be receiving the funding. And yes, a third institution could be party to both of those consortia.
And last quick question: the full application is listed online.
Say it again. Couldn't hear you on that last question.
Full application expected to be posted on the website. Or on grants.gov?
The application is posted online, in grants.gov.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Mary, was that our second question?
So I think we have just one more question.
We got one more? Okay.
All right, one more question. That will be from the line of the Yes from Sacramento State University. Ma'am, your line is open.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is more clarification on the restriction to provide stipends or scholarships to students that was mentioned earlier. So if in our proposal we are trying to include engagement activities such as internships and fellowships to provide incentives for students to cover their college expenses, would that be an allowable expense?
Thank you for the question. We will, just to reiterate what we said earlier, this could not be used as direct student aid, but I understand the the nuance of that question as to whether it was designed as part of a proposal, intervention, or project related to something that addressed these overall priorities. So we will take that one back and get back in touch with you on the answer to that question. We'll, we can include it in the questions and answers, the frequently asked questions and answers that is on the OPE website.
Which stands for the Office of Post-Secondary Education.
Okay, thank you.
Well, we're approaching 4 o'clock, and on behalf of Secretary Duncan and my colleagues here in the department, I want to thank all 400 of you for joining us today. We are really excited about this competition. I hope you can hear or sense our enthusiasm over the phone. What excites us is a lot of the activity that we know is sort of going forth in the higher education community and the great work that's happening on your campuses as we speak. So we are really looking forward to engaging you as we draw closer to the deadline for the competition. I do want to ask you to remember the 2 dates for the webinars, again, which is May 28th from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m., also June 4th from 1:30 to 3:30, and I want to remind you that you do have to register for the webinar as a measure of simply capacity. I think we had over 900 RSVPs for this call. Certainly could not accommodate that many, so I encourage you to register early for the webinars. Application deadline, again, is June 30th, and the awards could be announced on or before the 30th of September. So having said that,
James, I just want to quickly jump in because I think your line was breaking up just a little bit. Just to quickly re-review those dates, the webinars will be the May 28th and June 4th, 1:30 to 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time. The deadline for applications is June 30th, 2014. Awards will be announced by September 30th, 2014. And for additional information, I know that this is all on our website, so I just want to make sure folks know that they can go to ed.gov/FIPSE, ed.gov/FIPSE. You can also email any additional questions that you might have to opefirstintheworld@ed.gov. And we thank everyone for participating, and we look forward to reading your applications.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you, operator.
That's the end of the conference. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.